This is the story of two co-hosts with a podcast. One of them doesn't care enough to walk up to the ad copy read, so it's the other's job to team up with friends to keep it all together. This is Unscripted Direct. Jeez, that is always late. It's ridiculous. Now, I'm just going to start without him. Unscripted Direct is brought to you by Walk Up Melodia. Kelly and Schoenberger, based in San Francisco, but with cases all over the country. Walk Up is one of the most respected plaintiffs, personal injury, and wrongful death law firms. The attorneys at Walk Up are so passionate about trying cases, we created an initiative to join with smaller shops to try cases that otherwise wouldn't have the resources to be tried. We call it Walk Up Team Up. If you or a friend have a case and want to learn more, check it out at walkupteamup.com. We thank Walk Up for supporting this podcast and our trial advocacy community. Welcome to Unscripted Direct. I'm Spencer Palke from Berkeley Law, and I'm solo. Justin is off this week. Apparently, he had to do an interview with some leading law school podcast. I don't know. I wasn't really listening when he said it, but he's not here. He'll be back, though, next week, so have no fear. I will see, though, at that point, if we have room for him. I'll admit I've been interviewing some alternative co-hosts. More on that at the end of the episode here. But in honor of Justin, let's do a little preview of this week's episode. Here's what we've got. First, some tournament results. Second, Jared Rosenblatt is back, but this time he's bringing his anger translator along with him. And third, and of course, folks, I'm holding up the fingers. I said this was a tribute to Justin. Third, three fingers. It's the big interview with Justin. And to think it only took 88 prior episodes, spanning 127 hours and 33 minutes, 14 seconds. To convince Justin to be interviewed. All right, without further ado, we're going straight to the break. We start off with the Estrella Trial Advocacy Competition. The semifinalists were Inter-American University of Puerto Rico School of Law and the University of Illinois College of Law, that's Urbana-Champaign. And the finalist was the George Washington University Law School. And finally, our champion, American University Washington College of Law. Great job, folks. Going out much further west than Puerto Rico, going out to Las Vegas for the Amicus Cup. Our semifinalists were South Carolina and Drexel Klein. Our finalist was Baylor and the champion, Hofstra. We do have some other awards, folks, as well. Some excitement here to share with you. The Edward D. Olbaum Professionalism Award, known as the Eddie, that goes to Justin Bernstein. You may have heard of him, UCLA School of Law. And the Lifetime Achievement Award, that's going to go to Alvaro Bellido de Luna, A.J. Bellido de Luna, St. Mary's University School of Law. Those are both awards that are given at EATS this summer. Hope you can be there to congratulate these fine folks in person. Let me give you one more little award-related reminder, folks. Please vote for the semi-annual, biannual, I don't know, we do it twice a year, the Scripty Awards. Please vote. It's a lot of fun. We're going to announce the winners in our final episode of the season next week. Moving right along, Jared Rosenblatt is joining us, and as I said, with a very special guest. We welcome back to the pod Jared Rosenblatt and Judge Jim Roberts. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I got to start off with some congrats to both of you. You both had great years. You both just won Amicus Judging Awards. You're both nominated for a Scripty for Coach of the Year. Hofstra won Amicus and a bid to NTC Nationals. Cumberland was one of only two schools to earn four bids to NTC and AAJ Nationals. Congratulations, guys, on great years for you and your programs.
Thanks, Spencer.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that.
Last thing I said there was Nationals, and we're here to talk about NTC Nationals. And what I wanted to do is start off with the positives from the tournament. Jared, what are some of the positives that you drew from it?
Well, it's our first time attending Nationals in a long time. It had been 6 or 7 years. So it was great for the program and for the school to return to Nationals after a long break. And it also was a great representation of the hard work of my students for the entire year and culminating with the trip to Nationals. My second favorite part was getting to see my old friends, people from the community who I haven't seen in a while, and celebrating our achievements at the end of this year together.
Judge, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Jared, especially that last part. The camaraderie that we have within our community is very special, and the opportunity to see a lot of our friends from around the community and spend some time together in celebration of a long season and a lot of hard work, and for our students to get the opportunity to meet some of the coaches that they've heard me talk about, and also get to meet other students and build the relationships that will hopefully be with them throughout their careers.
And how about the involvement of coaches as part of the case review process this year? Thoughts on that as being a positive development, Jared?
I think one of the things that we could take away from the year is the fact that they finally embraced what's been needed, and that is involving coaches to edit and review fact patterns. I think universally what one of the weaknesses has been for this particular competition has been the fact patterns and the disparity between sides. But they did. And I think the regional competition, they got the coaches involved early. And I think the fact pattern was a lot better after that. And I think that is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think that getting coaches involved in the balance of the case and improving the case is a huge highlight, very positive. That's a big step. They've never done that before. Putting together a group to review the Nationals case before it was released was a huge positive step.
The other thing I was going to ask you guys about, and I'll start with you, Judge, on this one. I mean, they had plenty of judges again, and the banquets, of course, are a good time, and they're generously put on. Did you take that away as a positive, Judge?
Yeah, absolutely. It's nothing as disheartening as going to a competition and having insufficient numbers of judges. That's just disheartening. So having full complement of judges throughout the rounds is very, very positive. And of course, one thing they've always done well is have a good banquets and good events for us. And they once again did a really good job with that.
Well, Jared, so we actually asked you to join us for this segment. I mean, you're a frequent guest, of course, the most famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, segment you ever did was the 12 Angry Minutes segment, one of our most popular of all time. And when we asked you to come on to talk about NTC Nationals, you insisted that Judge Roberts join you, and obviously Judge is good company. We all know that. But I think you had another reason. I was wondering if you couldn't explain it for us.
Well, thank you, Spencer. I didn't know I was a ratings blitz for the show, but I appreciate the pat on the back or slap in the face. Listen, one of the great things about getting to know Judge over these years is that Judge gets me. I think it's the many years on the bench combined with many years representing criminal defendants. And so one of the issues regarding some of the other segments is people were like, I just don't understand what he's saying. So I thought I would bring my translator, and that would be my anger translator, Judge Roberts.
Oh, wow. So this is a whole new role you've got, Judge Roberts, I guess, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And based on my experience, I think Jared's nailed it pretty good. I'm fluent in anger, sarcasm, and vitriol. So I think this works out great.
That may be enough. Well, let's jump into it. I've been trying to bottle Jared up as much as I can so far, and I think I've reached the limits of my ability in that regard. And so let's dig into the case a little bit. Jared, what are your thoughts on the NTC Nationals case?
I think, like we said before, I want to say that Tyler took steps in an attempt to improve the fact pattern. Not everybody read the Tyler Nationals problem, but almost everybody had some involvement in reading the case about the stolen coats. And universally, that was panned as one of the worst cases of the year. Well, they outdid themselves. Nationals was worse. The fact pattern was poor at best. At first blush, everybody who read it knew it was going to be a problem. And it didn't let anyone down. It was exactly what it appeared to be, which was poor.
Judge, what? How do we interpret that?
Yeah, Jared's point is that the case could have been better constructed.
Oh, okay. I can see that makes sense now. I appreciate that. How about Jared? I want to look at the case balance aspects of the case, and I'm going to give you some numbers here, and I don't mean to set you off, but it was 59-41 in all prelims defense prosecution, and then 62-38 if you take out our eventual champions, UCLA. What are your thoughts on the case balance?
Well, if you speak to the people that were involved in attempting to assist the national trial competition with this fact pattern, a word on the street is that they had 7 days to fix their fact pattern, that they made a list for the fact pattern writer and the committee as to what needed to be done to make it better. And not every change was accepted. Many changes were summarily rejected. And I think it's evident in this horrific balance. I mean, the fact that it's a 60-40 split after a tournament or after prelims is an indictment on how bad a fact pattern is. You can't have a fact pattern 60-40 at a national competition. It's unacceptable. And it also, in addition to being unacceptable, it doesn't let the competition play out the way it should. There shouldn't be a competitive advantage as to what side you are on what day and when. And that's what it's become.
Judge, turning to you here to translate that for us.
Yeah, Spencer, I'm sorry. I need to get a little clarification from Jared. Is that okay?
Of course. Yeah, please.
All right. Jared, are you saying that you're angry and you're upset that the fact that the case wasn't balanced, and part of that was because they wouldn't listen to all the changes that were suggested by the coaches who reviewed it? And on top of that, there was judging based upon merit of the facts as opposed to the quality of the advocacy?
Judge, it would be like this was the first time they had the competition. I mean, what am I trying to say other than that? I couldn't be more clear.
All right, Spencer, I think I've got it now.
Yeah, please.
Yes, the problem was imbalanced, and the imbalance had many factors, from the poor construction of the problem to the lack of adopting the various suggestions made by the coaches' review committee, and two cases being judged upon the merits as opposed to upon the quality of the advocacy.
Got it. Wow. Thank you. Again, just a burst of clarity in my direction. I appreciate it. Okay. Well, so Jared, NTC did provide two enlargements for every trial and t-shirts for every team. I mean, I'm pushing back here a little bit, but that has to count for something, right?
Yeah. You know what's really helpful? What's really helpful is when you fly across the country and you don't have to bring exhibits. Right, saves a ton of money on baggage, and it saves a ton of money on administrative expenses. So what did they give us? They gave us two slightly larger than 8x11 blow-ups of things that didn't really matter. Here's what they didn't do. One of the exhibits in the fact pattern was a picture of two eyes. The problem was the photos of the eyes in the exhibits that they provided were the life-size photos of eyes. They were about 2 centimeters long. They didn't blow up those or provide a larger version of that. Here's another problem. I brought two advocates. I was lucky enough that the University of Houston provided us with local witnesses to save us a huge expense. But Judge here traveled with a third of a plane from Alabama to Texas. They flew. I think they even flew like through Wisconsin. That was the direction that they flew. And when they arrived, they didn't provide anything for the witnesses. So Judge spent $100,000 to fly his two teams, his water boy, his trial assistant, the guy who carries his judicial clipboard to draw post-round plays on where people should be walking in the courtroom. And none of them got a thing. Not an iota of a thank you from the Texas Young Lawyers, who, by the way, used to provide the witnesses. So now we have carried the expense of providing the witnesses to their tournament that they're hosting, and they didn't even get a $12 shirt. Sure, maybe Judge got a lunch voucher for a granola bar, but they didn't even recognize them with a T-shirt or a pen or a thank you. It's really a slap in the face to the people that are spending all of this money to travel, and the students who are giving up their classes and their time to assist their colleagues do this, not even a freaking shirt.
Judge?
Jared said that the expense of bringing witnesses has become onerous, and that at the minimum, they should be recognized with a T-shirt or some trinket showing their dedication to this activity that we commit so much time and energy to and money to, and that the exhibits were insufficient.
It's calmer, clearer, and shorter. I love it. Okay. So, Jared, let's talk about the coaches meeting. You had a question, as you sometimes do in large gatherings of mock trial coaches. You had a question for the leaders of TYLA. What was your question?
My question was, why is the third round announced already? Because at the coaches meeting, they produced three large blow-ups. Those were actual blow-ups of the pairings for rounds 1, 2, and 3. But round 3 and round 4, according to the rules, were supposed to be 1 versus 2, 3 versus 4. So I asked them, why are you announcing the pairings for round 3?
And their response was?
We've decided that this is how we're doing. So I then said, well, we're in this lovely hotel here. You've given us rules. You've printed them out in front of us. They're in front of all of the coaches in this room. The rules say that round 3 and round 4 are supposed to be 1 versus 2, 3 versus 4. And then we start to chase our own tail. Well, that was before we printed the rules. We made a change. There's no explanation. They did what they wanted to do.
And how satisfied were you with that explanation?
Oh, I was completely satisfied.
Yeah, Judge. So I guess, did you say sarcasm was included in your translation skills? I don't know. I'm going to have to turn to you, Judge.
Yes. Jared was not very satisfied with that response.
There we go. Excellent. Glad it's in the repertoire. Now, I've been laughing along here, as I often do, but I want to turn attention to the witness issue. There was a issue with a Tyla witness in an elimination round. Jared, can you tell us what happened?
Two schools competing were Lewis and Clark and UMKC. And I've heard this version from multiple people that were in the room when it happened. So it's the quarterfinal match, and the witness on the stand is playing a woman by the name of Sally, who's the housekeeper. For those not familiar with the fact pattern, it's a homicide case. Defendant is accused of murdering his spouse, and the housekeeper is testifying for the defendant. The housekeeper on the stand is being played by a Tyla representative, meaning someone that's either on the Tyla board or a Tyla member. Witness is asked on direct to describe the medical condition of the victim, which is the only issue in the case. On direct, asked about coughing. Quote, she was coughing all the time, probably because she caught syphilis. FYI, syphilis, not in the fact pattern. Asked about the personality. Quote, she's been ridden more than a merry-go-round horse. End quote. Later, asked about finding her deceased body. Quote, she had clearly been ridden hard and put away wet. End quote. On cross, asking about her appearance. Witness from a female advocate asking the questions, the only female advocate in the room, asked about the appearance. Witness, quote, she looked like a slut. Now, none of those things are in the fact pattern. None of those things are even a reasonable or even close to being a reasonable inference about it. And so the question is, how does this happen? Why does this happen? Right. And so the reason why this happens is because for years, Tyler as an organization has encouraged their own members, their own board members, to play this out as it's some sort of casting call for their membership, some sort of casting call for them to, I don't know, maybe cast the role of asshole, because it's unclear why in an educational experience somebody would do this. So what happens, right? At this point, now that the witness has been calling the deceased look like a slut, all four coaches stand up in the room and leave. All four coaches in the room are disgusted. All four of them march straight up to the Tyler room and say, hey, by the way, this wasn't something we asked them to do, like they needed to say that. And so the coaches, all of them, complain to the board. They come back down. They tell the ACTL evaluators, by the way, if you weren't aware, Sally was not prepped about syphilis. Sally was not prepped to say she was ridden more than a merry-go-round. That was just the witness. Okay. You would think that something would be done immediately. But no, Tyler doesn't do anything, okay? And so this witness then shows up that night to the event, the Friday night event. That witness then shows up to the Saturday night formal banquet. That witness actually gets confronted Saturday evening by one of the witnesses that was brought by one of the schools, because they were in disgust watching what took place. And so a 1L confronts this Tyler board member or Tyler member about what took place. And luckily for your viewers, this is all true, by the way. The second witness stands in close proximity and takes notes of what is being said by this ignoramus, okay? And so the 1L witness from one of the schools says, did they tell you to do that in the round, or were you taught to degrade women in the courtroom? And the Tyler rep says, yeah, we're taught that in Texas. Where are you from? Now, let me pause for a second. We all know plenty of lawyers from Texas. Who the hell is this guy to A, say that, and B, wear the fact that he's from Texas on his shoulders as some sort of onus to degrade everyone and demean the activity that we're trying to do? So what happens? The witness, who happens to be from Texas, says, actually, I'm from Texas. And so the Tyler person says, it's unfortunate you don't know what acting is. Maybe you should stick to something like family law or CPS, which is clearly an indictment on the fact that he's now degrading the female asking him these questions. Again, another reason why this guy should have been sent home. It doesn't end. So the 1L says, you shouldn't call women sluts in the courtroom. To which the Tyler representative says, I couldn't care less about your opinion and your feelings, and I hope you remember that. I got multiple problems here, Spencer, with what happened. I know I'm usurping your role as host, but I have multiple issues with what happened. First, Tyler should have immediately sent the person home. Okay, this guy should have been sent home immediately. He should have been told, don't go to the event Friday night. Don't go to the banquet Saturday night. You shouldn't have said what you said. Tyler hasn't. Okay. Second problem. After this occurred, one of the schools reached out now almost 3 weeks plus, sending an email to Tyler, to the executive director, to the past president of Tyler, saying, this is what happened, outlining what occurred in the courtroom and what occurred afterwards. To date, I don't believe they've responded. To date, they failed to acknowledge this. To date, they haven't sent an email out to everyone at National saying, we realized there was an issue with one of our witnesses. We realized that there was something that was inappropriate that occurred. It won't happen again. We're going to make changes to fix it. Silence. Nothing. Last problem, because I know I've been talking a while for my translator. Last problem. In the room were members of the ACTL. In the room, those attorneys who were judging the quarterfinal round at arguably the largest and biggest and most important tournament of the entire year, they should have stopped it. They should have said something. And if at the moment it was too great to say, hold on, at the break, they should have said something. At the feedback, they should have said something. They had an obligation. They had an obligation as members of this fraternity of lawyers that they are so quick to boast about. They had an obligation as the American College of Trial Lawyers to say something and take a position as to the behavior of this witness. And they didn't.
Judge.
So I don't think any translation is necessary. I will add that as a father of a 21-year-old woman who has always wanted to go to law school and is about to enter her senior year of college and just took the LSAT, as a husband of an incredible wife who happens to be an incredible lawyer also, and, you know, as a teacher and coach of more young women than I can count, and has prided myself on helping them develop great careers as strong female advocates. It is disturbing that this happened, and I will note that I received the exact same information that Jared did, almost to the word. From both what happened in the courtroom and what happened at the banquet. I've always had an issue with the TYLA lawyers' performance as witnesses. I've always thought it was against the educational principles that this activity is about, that it should not be about them. It should be about the students and the educational benefit that they can derive from participating, especially at the higher levels, when the TYLA lawyers start playing the witnesses. It's far too often been about those lawyers and not about the students. This is well beyond that. This is reprehensible behavior that needs to be addressed and should be addressed.
So why the silence, right? Why the silence for almost 3+ weeks? Is it an endorsement of the behavior? Is it TYLA saying, we understand what happened? It's part of the competition. We understand what happened. We encourage people to think outside the box. We understand what happened. Witnesses say crazy things on cross-examination and direct during real trials. What is the rationale? What logical and reasonable explanation does TYLA have for not doing anything about it?
Judge?
Yeah, I can't answer Jared's question, obviously, and nor does he expect me to. But I think the question has to be answered. I will. I try to put myself in people's positions before being too critical. I would hope that there are internal discussions occurring of which we're unaware at this time. And I trust that there are.
Well, we will obviously watch this issue closely. Couldn't agree more about the comments you all made. And it's such a good point that when this is a game or thought of as a game by the TYLA folks about how the witnesses, what the performances are and that it's fun for them, you will end up with, first of all, not a good educational experience. Okay, that's just par for the course when you have that approach to it. But it's going to create these circumstances. This will happen. If it's a performance and it's thought to be fun and what can you say and get away with, like, this is going to happen and it's completely unacceptable. I will go back to being host and I will ask about the future. Jared, what are your parting thoughts here? Do you have maybe comments or hopes for the future for TYLA?
I'll finish where I started with. My hope is that the national trial competition recognizes that there are massive problems that exist with what they're doing and how they're doing it. My hope is that the fact patterns being as bad as they are, the witness situation being as problematic as that's as polite as I can put it, as it was, that they take steps to fix it. Next year, as they announced this year, will be the 50th anniversary of the tournament. And the trial competition world is in a drastically different place than it was 40 years ago, 30 years ago, and 20 years ago. When this competition started, it was the only one that existed. There's close to 40 tournaments a year. And so what began as a competition where everyone was I'll say forced or excited to participate in because it was the granddaddy of them all, isn't what it once was because of its competition. And so I think that it's time for the national trial competition to take a step forward and realize if they don't make steps to advance their competition and to move with the times, that other people will take those steps for them. This isn't me. This isn't my anger speaking. This is the community speaking already. There are conversations to take steps forward to create a new competition that will do this. No one's looking to eliminate 49 years of history. People worked way too hard, you all included, to compete at nationals, do well at nationals, for schools to win national trial competition, national titles, and have them at their law school. I'm not suggesting the elimination of the national trial competition. What I'm suggesting is it's time for it to get fixed and to truly accept the community at large for what it is, which is way bigger than what it used to be. Let the people who do this for a living, the trial competition directors, the full-time faculty, the tenure track people, the deans at law schools who did this community from the beginning, let them fix this, or it will be fixed by its elimination.
Judge?
You know, I'm in a unique position in that I have coached over half the years that NTC has been in existence. I've coached NTC. Of course, that just means I'm old, but I've been blessed to be at nationals 17, 18 times in that period. I can't remember exactly. I've been around. There's very few of us left who've been around as long as I have and have seen this. And so the history of what NTC has been is meaningful. But even folks who are newer, like, you know, Justin or Jared or yourself, there is a history to your experiences with NTC, which is important. And none of us want to see those go by the way of a dusty old book that is forgotten. We want to see NTC listen to the community, work with the community to make NTC what it used to be, what it can be. And I think there's just a sometimes in an isolated event such as NTC, they don't understand the breadth of the community nor how the entire landscape has changed, as Jared pointed out. There is a significant difference in what this activity is and the quality of tournaments that are being put on. All three of you put on high quality tournaments that people want to participate in. And I don't know that understanding of the progress, of the growth, of the change in our activity is fully appreciated. And to keep up, you know, you either got to keep up or get left behind. And NTC needs to do a better job of keeping up. And we're willing. Several of us have offered help and have had that help received sometimes. We want to help move it forward and protect it. But make no mistake about it, Jared's correct. There is a large swell in the community that has continued to grow year by year the last few years for an alternative to MTC.
Let me translate the judge a little bit, and what he's saying is the same thing that Taylor Swift said in Antihero, which is, "It's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me. Hey, Tyler, it's you. You're the problem, right? And so fix it. It's fixable. You've been given the playbook. You've been given the answer key. All you have to do is accept it."
Well, with that, thanks, Jared. Thank you, Judge, for sharing your thoughts. A little bit of humor, but a lot of seriousness, which I greatly appreciate. This was fun, guys. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Spencer. And I will say that when I tell my daughter that I have been translated by Taylor Swift, it will make her day and mean a lot more to her than anything else I do.
See you guys.
Thanks.
Well, that was a fun bit, I will say. Of course, had some very serious moments. And I'll tell you, honestly, when I first heard about what had happened with the witnesses, with the witness, rather, I was shocked. I was completely shocked that that happened. And I remain shocked at how completely and wildly unacceptable it is that it happened, and that it apparently has not yet been addressed. I will stop moralizing on that, but say, again, really fun to have Jared and the judge on to share some thoughts about the NTC national competition. Now, folks, this must mean that it could only be time for the big interview with Justin Bernstein on the podcast, but I've got him on the other side of the microphone. This was a lot of fun. I will be honest with you. I prepped like crazy for it. I prepped like I was going to cross-examine the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. I had exhibits. I had spoken to witnesses. I was laying and setting traps, or trying to. I kid a little bit there. I wasn't trying to set traps, but I was prepared because I wanted to do a good job interviewing our good friend, Justin Bernstein. Please introduce yourself to the jury.
Hi, my name is Justin Bernstein.
What do you do?
I'm the director of trial advocacy and a professor at UCLA School of Law.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Where are you from?
I was born in New Jersey, but my family moved to California when I was in the fifth grade.
What did your parents do?
My father was a small town lawyer. He did general practice, whatever walked in the door, whether it was wills or divorces or a small criminal case. My mom was a marketing executive. When I was younger and we were living in New Jersey, she would commute to New York, work at a big publishing house. And when we were in California, she would do a lot of freelance work before working for some major companies.
How young were you when you first decided you wanted to be a lawyer?
I was in the fifth grade when I first became interested in becoming a lawyer, and it was sort of by accident. There was a local community college, I think it was Montclair State or something like that, that had weekend courses for, they would say, academically inclined youth. In other words, nerds. I really wanted to do a math and logic course. And the way it worked is that if you signed up for a course in math and logic, you also had to take something in either rhetoric or language or social studies. And I wanted to take two math classes. My parents were like, nope, the rules are you have to do both. And so they said, why don't you do a law class? I'm like, fine, as long as I get to do my math problems. And I ended up loving the law class. I was in fifth grade, and I think the others were sixth, seventh, eighth mostly. And I got to do a closing argument at the end of the trial. That was a blast.
You had a challenging relationship with your father. And your father, of course, was a lawyer. We often do things of people that we admire. And I'm wondering how that squares up in your mind, that you would be at a young age wanting to become a lawyer, just like your dad.
You're right. My relationship with my father was at best complicated. He was not somebody I would call admirable. I guess I don't think I wanted to become a lawyer because of him. I think I wanted to become a lawyer because it really spoke to things that were important to me, and things where I thought I could make a difference and be good at.
That's interesting, because I would have a hard time compartmentalizing that. I would just, to become a lawyer would be to become the thing that my dad was. And that was true in my case.
but it is, doesn't really line up that way for you? You just don't really think about it that way?
I don't.
You were born in New Jersey, then moved to Southern California. First, when was that move?
We moved while I was in the fifth grade.
So tell us about the move. How did the move itself go?
I remember very well my first day of school. It was Skyline Elementary. My mom dropped me off. And before she gave me a hug and a kiss and said, good luck, she said, try to blend in today. Just try to fly under the radar. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, just try to blend in. I was in Mrs. Turner's class. She was very nice. And they welcomed the new student. And then she said, today's lesson is about homonyms. And she explained what a homonym is and said, can anyone think of an example? And a couple of people gave examples. And I was like, I have an idea. I'm like, nope. Mom told me to blend in. I'm just gonna sit here. But she called on me and she said, can you think of a homonym? And I said, precipitate. She's like, okay, can you use that in two sentences? I said, sure. There was so much moisture in the clouds that they precipitated. And also, Watergate precipitated Nixon's downfall. And all these heads turned and stared at me. And I'm like, I think I know what my mom was concerned about.
Now, you also moonlighted as a magician. What was your best performance?
This is so much more humiliating than I feared it would be.
This is completely charming.
I assume the risk. All right, what's the question?
The question is, tell us what we see in the next exhibit, which I'm now showing you.
Okay, this looks like my brother's birthday party one year, where my parents, too cheap to hire actual talent, had me perform as the magician at my brother's birthday party. I'm wearing a suit and a red tie. My brother's wearing a suit and a red bow tie. What bothers me here is that I'm wearing red. This is before I grew to hate Stanford.
That was an incomplete description here. First of all, my understanding of the story is that there was a magician who was hired but did not show. And
yeah, right.
Heroically, Justin went home with his dad, changed, put on his attire, which we see here. It does have a red tie, but it's a very nice suit and a top hat as well, or a hat.
That's true. I am wearing a top hat. That's right.
Yeah. And perform magic tricks at Burger King for Ari, your younger brother's birthday.
Yeah.
I would say more importantly, look at the look on Ari's face. He is shorter than Justin. Many people are. But in this particular, especially so, I think you're what, 4 years apart? Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. He is looking up at you in utter and total admiration. And you are glowing, smiling, having put on, no doubt, a fabulous magic show for your brother. It's just such a sweet photo. So
it is a really cool photo.
Yeah. It really is nice. To be fair, life as a child for you was not just Quiz Bowl and magician work at Burger King. You also played sports. Which ones?
I played basketball.
How competitive was your spirit when it came to basketball?
I would say I was highly competitive, lowly skilled.
How did you, I've been curious about this. How did you deal with that? Like a highly competitive person generally and really good when it came to, you know, all challenges of the mind and, you know, perhaps less good at you know, the physical requirements of basketball, but equally competitively driven.
I love being on a team. And there are times when, based on what we're competing in, I can be a leader of a team, and that's great and that's fun. But when I was the 11th or 12th guy on the basketball team, that was also really fun. Like, I loved cheering for my teammates. I loved working hard in practice with them. I felt like their wins were my wins, and it was great. I mean, the 7 minutes I got to play that season were awesome.
In basketball, do you have any nicknames out there on the court?
If your research has been able to find them, good for you. I'm not going to volunteer them. let's see what you got.
Does Cool Breeze ring any bells?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that was not the one I was afraid of. But yes, I believe that at a basketball summer camp, my air balls were described as a cool breeze. And so for that week, I was Cool Breeze. I forgot about that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm looking for.
That's not even the worst basketball nickname I had in high school. So
I'm going to have to check with my sources who are obviously
good luck.
Obviously protective of you.
Good luck.
Okay, before we move on from your childhood, which we will do momentarily.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a few specific questions for you based on my research. Your nickname as a baby, do you recall what it was?
Gripper.
Gripper, correct. And why was that?
I'm told that I squeezed people's fingers really tightly when I was really little.
Yeah, I've got a very cute photo of it here.
I was not a good-looking baby. My mother famously said to my grandfather, my father's father, the good news is that Justin's healthy. The bad news is he looks like you. And I did look like a bald man in his 60s when I was a baby.
I think it's a really cute photo. Senor Bear was your high school Spanish teacher.
I remember Senor Bear.
How would you describe his expectations for your future?
He was not optimistic.
And why is that? So
I was, and this is true, I think, of most areas of my life. I'm either all in or not at all in. And I was not at all in when it came to studying Spanish. I was a terrible student in Spanish. And I will say, I was really good the first week of Spanish. Like Spanish 1, week 1, I was great, which is why most of my knowledge of Spanish consists of numbers, colors, and office supplies.
Mm.
So like, you know, the first week they're like, oh, you need to make sure you get a notebook. Why there though, right? Like I know those words. I know nothing else. I can't conjugate. I never learned verbs. It was a problem. But I had to take multiple years. And so Senor Bear was my Spanish teacher, I think, in Spanish 2. And he just thought I was a moron. Like he said, what's the day after Cinco de Mayo? And I said, Cinco de Seis. And they all thought it was so funny. And I later understood why that was funny. But I remember seeing him as a senior. I passed him the hallway. You know, other people are like, oh, where are you going to college? You going here? Are you going there? And he's like, are you going to college? So he did not have high expectations for me.
Where did you go to college?
UC Berkeley. Go Bears.
Go Bears. Why'd you go to Cal?
This is going to be the most humiliating answer I've ever given on the show.
I'm afraid of what the answer is.
I didn't get into Stanford.
So as a young college student at Cal, what did you, what kept you busy?
So my big activity in high school was academic team called Quiz Bowl in some parts of the country, basically Team Jeopardy. I thought that I would do that when I got to Cal. I joined the team, but it wasn't as much fun. I didn't like the group as much as I did in high school. And so my sophomore year in college, I was looking for a new activity. And I found the club table for mock trial at the student group event at the beginning of the year. And there was a tall woman with blonde curly hair. And I said, I want to join this activity. And that was mock trial. I was on the team for the next 3 years. She and I dated for 8 years. That was my college experience.
So yeah, your sophomore year, which team were you on?
I was on either the D or the E team. In fact, we weren't even supposed to compete at regionals, not because there wasn't space, but they said that we weren't good enough. And at the last minute, we were permitted to compete at regionals.
And you didn't just compete. What was the result?
My team earned a bid to nationals.
Law school, where'd you go?
NYU.
Why'd you go to NYU?
I thought it was a great school, and I really liked their focus on practical skills. I wanted to do the Federal Defender Clinic. That was something that was really attractive to me.
Did you apply to Stanford?
I did.
Why?
Because they're one of the top 10 schools in the Bay Area.
Did they deign to give you permission to join their entering class?
They did.
How did you let Stanford know you were headed elsewhere?
So I sent them a rejection letter, letting them know that while I appreciated the offer, there were other qualified schools to which I've been admitted, but I wished Stanford the best in their future endeavors. The truth is, I wasn't upset at Stanford for rejecting me. I was a really bad high school student. I tested well, but I was not good in class. Like if I wasn't interested, I just didn't study. So I do well in, say, AP math, but then do poorly in like a regular history class. I was really bad about studying and being motivated. And I wasn't particularly scholarly in college. Like I was better, but there's a certain irony now that I'm in academia because I was not a good student.
Now, when you were a 2L at NYU, you had a 1L from Cal who you knew basically live on your couch for about a month. Who was that?
That was David Yaroslavsky. You must have talked to him too.
I guess I have to ask you, I mean, you are so much more flexible than I am and you go out of your way to help people. You'll pick them up at the airport. You'll offer to have them stay at your house. You'll have somebody sleep on your couch for a month in law school. No big deal. How do you do that?
Number one, I'm pretty sure Dave was there way more than a month. Number two, it wasn't really by choice. Dave is awesome. He was my teammate and friend from college, and he came to NYU a year after me. So I was happy to help him out.
Did you do mock trial at NYU?
I didn't.
Why not?
The NYU law school team was not very competitive. I don't mean that they weren't good. That might also be true, but they weren't focused on competition. They weren't trying to excel. And I'd come from a college team that was super competitive. And I just didn't think that it'd be a good environment if I really wanted to be competitive and the others didn't. And so I focused my energy on coaching the college team at NYU.
Okay, let's come back to Ari. Because at this juncture, you being in law school, Ari, of course, has grown up a bit. And let's actually introduce Ari, at least presently. What's Ari do these days?
My brother is a PhD from Columbia who works for the NBA, the National Basketball Association. He does some talent development work. He does work with the referee operations. He helps make the NBA more efficient and helps them identify internal talent. He's amazing.
That is obvious to me. I got the chance to talk with him, as you may guess. And man, that guy is brilliant.
You talked to my brother?
Yeah, I did. We're going to have drinks in New York next time I'm there.
That's so cool.
Also a very handsome man, you know, brilliant and handsome, you know?
It's really annoying.
How'd you two, and I know we're, you know, chronologically, we're moving around a little bit here, but we got to be flexible. How'd you two get along growing up?
We were really close. We hung out together. We played video games together. We played basketball together. We watched so much baseball and basketball and football together. I mean, we were huge baseball fans. We would literally watch baseball every day all summer. We'd go swimming. We'd play ping pong. I mean, my brother's like was my best friend growing up. I mean, he's just my favorite.
How would you describe relationship now?
I'm just so proud of him. I wish he were in California, but I get to talk to him and try to visit as often as I can. He's married to a wonderful woman, Shima, and they have an incredible daughter, Soraya, and I just adore them.
How'd they meet, Ari and Shima?
So I will not at all humbly say that this is the best thing I've ever done in my whole life.
Ooh, go on.
Shima was my student at UC Irvine. She was on the mock trial team, and she had all the things you look for in your sibling's future spouse. She was reliable. She was punctual. She was good at checklists. She returned phone calls briskly. Now, Shima's just wonderful. She was always happy and friendly, but also warm and mature. And she told me at the end of our first year working together that she was going to be abroad for the semester the next year, and she wouldn't be able to compete. And I knew my brother was going to be abroad at the same time after he graduated. And I said, tell you what, I'll pay for your third date. Because I figured if they go on three dates, they are definitely going to fall in love and get married. And they didn't listen to me. They didn't meet each other in Europe even once. But I am, if nothing else, persistent.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started telling people that they'd gone out and that they were dating. And she returned to the team. And I'd say, like, oh, how are things, Laurie? And she's like, I've not met him. I'm like, oh, you don't have to be coy. And it was, I mean, because if you're going to invent a relationship, you have to make sure that it progresses. And so, you know, I'd say things like, oh, I hear it's getting serious. And then eventually I said, you know, they're thinking about moving in together. They've not met. Understand, they have not met at this point. It got so bad that when they finally met 3 years later, somebody came up and congratulated them on their engagement. And they swore, of course, we're not going to date. Of course, we're not going to date because you've ruined it. You've just been so obnoxious. We wouldn't give you that satisfaction. And now,
met.
And now they are married with a child and happy. So take that. If you can imagine the most obnoxious best man speech you've ever heard, double it. And that was my best man speech.
Let's get back to work here. All right. Quit goofing around. Okay. So after you graduate, you head off to O'Melveny & Myers. What kind of work do you do there?
I was doing commercial litigation and mostly securities litigation, representing large companies, mostly public companies, in shareholder suits.
Did you enjoy it?
At first, I liked the fact that it was different, and I really like writing. And so I was getting to do a lot of writing. I think eventually I became bored.
Why'd you leave? And when was it that you left?
I left in 2010. So I'd been there 4 years and I left because it wasn't fun anymore. Like I didn't hate it. I think a lot of people go to big firms, they just hate it or they feel overwhelmed. I didn't feel that way. I just woke up one morning and I said, I'm not enjoying this. And I promised myself I wouldn't do this longer than I enjoy it. I gave notice that week. It was either the bravest or stupidest thing I've ever done.
So let's find out. Let's keep going. So you left to what did you leave to do?
I didn't have a plan of what to do. And at first I was like, oh, I shouldn't leave unless I have a plan. But I'm like, no, like I have never not worked. I mean, I went straight from college to law school and I worked the summer before college and I worked the summer after college and I didn't do a bar trip really. And so it's like, I'm going to travel. So I did 2 months in Europe, which was both fun and harrowing. Anybody who knows my sense of direction knows that it's fortunate I returned. And then I tried to figure out what I wanted to do next. And in the meantime, I coached at UCI undergrad. I taught at UCI law school, or I should say I ran their brand new trial program. Your now dean, Erwin Chemerinsky, was the dean of that brand new law school. And so I worked for him. But most of my time and most of my income was from playing poker.
How often did you play? Where did you play?
It varied. There'd be times when I play every day for, 2 weeks. There'd be times when I didn't play at all for 2 weeks. I played a lot in Southern California, especially San Diego. I played a lot in Las Vegas. I played some in Europe.
But was it profitable? I mean, were you able to support yourself with it?
I did well.
What's the best hand you ever had?
The best hand I've ever had was like something out of a movie. Yeah. It was crazy. Did my brother tell you this in your research?
Keep going.
Okay. So we're playing at the Mandalay Bay in 2006. And I was dealt Jack Queen of Spades. And I was in the last position on the dealer button. And everybody limped in, meaning they just put in the blinds. And I thought this is a good hand for a big pot or a big group. And so I raised $15. And shockingly, everybody called. Everybody called. So we had 10 players to the flop. And the flop came King of Spades, 10 of Spades, Ace of Diamonds.
Ooh.
Meaning I had the best possible straight. I had 4 to a flush and I had an open-ended straight flush draw, meaning either the 9 or the ace of spades would give me a straight flush, a potential royal flush. Everybody check, 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 check the flop. I bet in 120 because I figured I don't want to see any more spades because I don't want to lose to an ace high flush that somebody else might have. I got a bunch of callers, including some all-ins, and then even bigger money on the turn when it was a 10. The river was an ace of spades. Now, it turns out I did not need the ace of spades because nobody else had a better hand anyway. But that gave me a royal flush on the river. The pot was several thousand dollars. My brother, I still remember this. He stood up on his chair in the casino and did his impression of Matt Damon from Good Will Hunting and said, "My boy's wicked smart." It was awesome. And then we went back and at 5 a.m. ate way too much food at the 24-hour diner at the Wynn.
Now, we can't be on our highest highs all the time. I was also encouraged to ask, what was your worst beat?
I remember going on a trip to the Wynn a couple years later. Just got there, sat down at the, I think it was a 2-5 table or 5-10 table. No, it was a 5-10 table. I bought in for, I think, $1,500. And on my first hand, I had pocket kings all in on the before the flop, which is what you want. The other guy had aces. I lost everything. 5 minutes later, I get aces. All in before the flop. Some guy had kings. The king hit. I lost again. And so that is the only time I've ever gotten up from the table because I was just not in the right mindset. I was like, I am not going to be able to play intelligent. Because so much of being successful in poker is being able to not go on tilt. That's the expression in poker, to stay calm regardless. And I'm pretty good at having a bad result and just not letting it shake me.
Yeah.
That is one time where I thought, I don't think I can play very coherently right now. This is very bad luck. I'm going to walk around.
That actually gets me to my next question or the community's next question. How does your poker playing affect your life when not playing? I mean, do you take lessons from the poker into life?
I don't know which way it flows, whether the poker helps other things or the rest of my life helps me as a poker player, but there's certainly some real life lessons to be drawn from poker. Preparation, keeping a level head, evaluating and appreciating risk, like not being afraid of it, but also being respectful of it. Sometimes playing the cards, sometimes playing the opponent.
Does the poker playing affect your coaching?
I think so. You're looking for optimal strategies. You're looking to learn from others. You have to acknowledge that there's a certain amount of luck, whether it's the next card that comes out or the next judge you draw. It's dealing with a bad result. And sometimes, I mean, this is one of the crucial things about playing poker. When you lose, you have to be good at evaluating, did I lose because I got unlucky and therefore I should continue to do what I was doing? Or did I lose because I made a mistake? And you see this in mock trial coaching. There are times when it's easy to go, oh, we've had all this bad luck. I'm not going to change anything. It's just, this judge was terrible. We had bad luck. We drew a hard schedule. And you don't want to do that. You want to be frank with yourself about why you didn't get the results you wanted. At the same time, you don't want to overreact to everything and say, oh, we lost. I must have done this wrong. So being fairly reflective of why you're getting the results you're getting is really important in any competitive endeavor.
Why'd you stop? Because you go back to practice in 2012.
I was bored. It's not a game where you feel like you're accomplishing anything. I mean, obviously, you want to make money, but you're not building anything.
So you've already mentioned it, but coming back to coaching, because you're practicing, but you're also coaching at the same time. Alongside your work, just give us the overview of how it lines up with the coaching that you were doing at the same time. Certainly UCI 2010 to 2012, but give us that overview.
When I started at O'Melveny in 2006, I just finished law school. I also started coaching the UC Irvine team. And you asked me how I dealt with it doing that and legal practice. The first thing I did was I tried to keep them totally separate. I never wanted my law firms to know how much I was coaching, because if they knew, they would probably not be happy that I was not billing more hours. But I loved it. I spent a ton of time on it.
And so was it UCI only that you were coaching up until Drexel when you go do it full time?
No. So, because I coached NYU when I was in law school, right, I continued to work with them even when I was back in California. And then when I stopped coaching at UC Irvine, I started working with a lot of high school teams. I did high school mock trial consulting, which I don't think was a thing before I started doing it. I don't know, but I got some interest from high school teams to work with them. And sometimes it was like a training academy, or I'd go work with them for a day, or I'd help them prepare for a tournament.
How many states have you done that in? I think it's quite a few, isn't it?
I don't remember anymore exactly how many, but I want to say I worked with schools from more than 10 states. Yeah. I had more than 50 clients over a few year period. And I was thinking about doing it full time.
Well, I'm glad you didn't do that. It would have been great, but I'm glad you
did. Me too. I am so much happier with the path that fell into my lap.
In 2014, you were inducted into the AMTA Coaches Hall of Fame. As of that time, you'd led three schools to national top 10 finishes as a captain and three-time All-American for UC Berkeley's student-run team, as a coach for NYU's 2010 national championship, and as a coach when UC Irvine twice finished number one in AMTA's power rankings. What did it mean to you to be inducted into the AMTA Coaching Hall of Fame?
It meant a lot because the people who'd been in it before were really some of the most accomplished coaches in the history of the organization. And the way it works is they're the ones who vote in the next person. And so being selected by people that I admired was very cool. It was very cool.
When did you first start coaching at the law school level?
I had an unusual introduction to law school trial competitions. My very first tournament was Top Gun because I was at UC Irvine, where they got a wild card selection. And then one of my former Irvine students from college was a wild card selection in 2015. That's Rahul Hari from NYU. And so the first two tournaments I ever coached were Top Gun.
So you moved to coaching on the law school level full-time in 2017 at Drexel Klein, but how do you get there?
On January 19th, 2017, I got an email with the subject, setting up a time to chat, from Gwen Stern, the Director of Trial Advocacy and Professor of Law at Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. It says, "Hi, Justin. Liz Lippi gave me your name and told me that you might be interested in moving to the East Coast. We may be looking for a new trial ed faculty member, so I'd love to chat with you sometime. Best, Gwen."
Boom. And where did that lead?
And I thought, there's no way I'm going to the East Coast, and there's no way they're going to hire me. I don't have the resume of the people who get these jobs. I got to do some trials, but I was at a big firm. So I thought, this isn't going anywhere, but I'll take the call. And the call went great. And I thought, okay, this is lovely, but there's no way I'm going to go to the East Coast. And I came out to do the interview because why not? And I realized when I was there that I was in the right place. And this is so obvious in hindsight, but they were going to pay me to do what I'd been doing for free forever. That the things that I love doing, the thing that I hid from my employer because I liked it more than what I was doing as my job. They wanted me to teach and coach trial skills at a school that was really invested in it. It was not an easy decision because my whole life was in California, family, friends, career, everything I knew. It wasn't an easy decision, but it was the right decision.
And when you made it, did you figure I will be here indefinitely?
I didn't know. I was willing to take that risk. I think in the back of my mind, I thought I'll certainly be here a bunch of years because there aren't many jobs like that. There's only been one full-time job that's opened up in the last 6 years in California, in Southern California, I think two in all of California. And so I figured the likelihood that a job opens up is low. The likelihood that I get it is low. So I assumed I would be at Drexel for the foreseeable future, and I was excited about that.
So as it turned out, you spent a year at Drexel. And what were the highlights?
I think the obvious answer is the competitive highlights. We won Tournament of Champions as the first tournament of the year, and Phil and Jess won Top Gun at the end of the year. But I think every coach can relate to this. Those are not the highlights. The highlights are getting to work with students who are going to use these skills in practice. I mean, I worked with students that year who I'm still close with, 6 years later. I got to work with Dean Filler and Gwen Stern. I loved Philadelphia. I mean, I love the city. You can walk everywhere. I love the blue collar feel. I got to be there when they won the Super Bowl and to see how insane those people are. I love the cheesesteaks and the hoagies and the unhealthy food. It is really my kind of city.
After a tremendously successful year right out of the gates at Drexel, you left after a year. How did that come to pass, and how hard was that decision for you?
At the very beginning of my second semester there, the UCLA job became available. I didn't apply thinking that I would necessarily take it, and I certainly didn't think I would get it. That is not false modesty. I just knew it was a fancy school doing a national search. I'd only been doing this full-time for a semester, and the job description was not at all focused on coaching. In fact, you weren't supposed to get to do any coaching. It was supposed to be all curricular design. I didn't have much experience. I should say this is kind of funny. I gave the worst interview answer I've ever given in my life when I did the first interview with UCLA.
Well, we better hear that.
It was over Zoom, and I was across the screen from the head of the experiential department and a longtime faculty member. And the first question in the interview was a fair one, given that the job was about designing curriculum. They said, "What would you do with the curriculum?"
Mm.
And I said, and I quote, "I don't know. I've never thought about it."
Bingo.
And I was like watching myself say it. And I'm like, why did he say that? And across the screen, I saw their faces go, why did he say that? And so there was a slight pause, thank goodness, where they were trying to see if this was a prank. And I then proceeded to give a several minute answer about what I would do. But I knew, I'm like, there's no way I'm getting a call back. That was the stupidest answer.
But you did, and you get the offer. I think it's a little bittersweet to accept it. Is that right?
It was really hard. I knew by the end that it was the right decision because it was, in California where everybody who I was super close with, or most of my family and friends were, it was a great opportunity to run a program. It was a brand new program, so I get to shape it however I wanted. But I really loved Drexel. I think I got choked up when I told Dean Filler. I went to his office and I remember getting teary. I didn't expect to, but it was really hard.
The UCLA program was basically there for you to form as you liked. In retrospect, it's easy for me to say, oh, I see the things Justin has done differently. I'm curious, differently from the rest of the field. I'm curious if when you walked in the door, you already knew you had these things you were going to do differently.
Yes. As far as the existing curriculum, like in the classroom, there were things that I wanted to change at UCLA that UCLA had been doing for a while. But those are actually things that I wanted to become more like what other law schools were doing. So borrowing what I'd seen at Drexel, borrowing from other schools and how I know they approached teaching trial skills.
I'm going to read this into the record.
Okay.
Under your leadership, UCLA has reached heights never before reached in this activity. In a period of time, when the activity has never been more competitive. An incomplete recap would include, since 2019, 3 TOC wins, 3 AAJ wins, and 4 NTC wins, including 3 where UCLA closed out the final round. In total, UCLA has had 37 wins, which means it wins 49% of the tournaments it enters. In the Gavel rankings, UCLA has amassed 337 points since 2019, more than 4 times as much as the team with the second most wins. Question is, can you just give us an example, just one thing that you think that you do differently than most folks do? Because you got the evidence, which is the outcomes. And so I think it's obvious that some things are happening differently, and it'd be nice to get a sense of one of the things you think that you do differently at UCLA that helps lead to this success.
Before you cut me off, I need to say that like any school that's successful, it's not one thing or one person. And I think that because I'm on a podcast, because I'm the loan director, that I get sometimes more credit for what so many people are doing than is appropriate. We have a really supportive dean and administration. I have amazing students. And I've got now incredible alumni who are coaches. I think that's really important. I think that I approach things differently as a coach because I was coached differently than most of the people who do this, in that I had no coach. When I did this in college mock trial, we used to joke that Tom Cruise is our coach because we'd watch A Few Good Men to learn how to try cases. I really thought that when there was a relevance objection, you could just turn to the jury and explain to them what your relevance was, because that's what Tom did in the movie. I think that it made things really hard as a early competitor and as a young coach. But the one thing that really helped me is that nobody was telling me how you're supposed to do this stuff. And so you had to figure it out. And that meant that things that might be conventional wisdom that might not be right, I wasn't relying on. And so I had to figure out what worked. And I've always wanted to win more than I wanted to be right. I've always wanted to find the most effective answer more than what appealed to me or what I personally thought. And so it's been years of trial and error trying to find the best trial strategies. And I'm still trying to get better at this.
And can you give us an example, just like a classic example to you in your mind of something that you all do differently based upon your desire to get it right?
Here's one. I think that most people get a case problem and they say, okay, how do we use all the evidence? I don't want to use all the evidence. I want to use the evidence that lets me tell the story I want to tell. In fact, I want to use the least evidence I can to tell that story. I'm not saying I want to avoid evidence. I'm saying that I want the simplest story. And so what is the simplest, cleanest story I can tell, particularly in a world where you only have 60 minutes to tell that story?
Then over time, are you saying that there's situations where there's a potentially juicy piece of evidence where you are asking, where you're just foregoing it and not using it? I guess I can answer that question myself. I know you've done that before. Is that ever hard to be like, you know what, this may be tempting, but we're just not going to do it?
Absolutely. Because one of the things I talk to students about, and this is just on the team, but in class, very rarely is there something that's a good piece of evidence or a bad piece of evidence. It's good for your theory or bad for your theory. I remember this when I was a law student. I had a client I was representing in our federal defender clinic, and he was accused of possessing illegal drugs, and he claimed that the backpack wasn't his. That's a really useful fact if you're trying to deny possession. It's a really unuseful fact if you're trying to challenge the search. And so what your theory is, what your strategy is, affects whether evidence is good or bad. And that's why I don't let my students start with T-charts with good evidence, bad evidence, P evidence, D evidence. What are your available theories? And under each theory, what evidence helps and hurts you?
Is that how you tack the fact pattern? I mean, what's the first, when you get that fact pattern, what's your first step?
I try to understand what the legal issues are. And I read through the case. And the first time, I'm not trying to pick a theory. I'm trying to identify all the available theories. And I think it's really important not to be closed-minded and go, well, this one's better than that one. You don't know yet, or at least I don't know yet. I don't even want my students to come into the first meeting saying, this is what I think we should do. This is what our theme should be. Because you can't have a theme until you have a theory. I want to know, what are the theories? And then what are the facts in support of each? What are the facts against? What favors some and disfavors others? And once we have an idea of what theory we want, then we can start building it out. Then we can start talking about things like themes and broader strategies.
How often does your theory change over the course of a, you know, competition preparation period?
it almost never changes. Not because we're unwilling to change, but because we put in so much time and thought on the front end in selecting the theory. I know from when I coach college or when I talk to folks who coach law school, sometimes they'll scrimmage and say, oh, it didn't work. We're going to start over. I'm not going to say we never scrap something after a scrimmage, but it's pretty rare because we've thought it through so much beforehand. We know what we're looking for. And so we put a ton of time into first drafts and they don't tend to change very much.
Let's go through some parts of trial. What are the hallmarks of a UCLA opening statement?
I'm guessing here, but I would guess that what other people view as what makes a UCLA opening statement ours is probably different than what I'm seeing.
Let's break it down. What do you guess that others see?
A story at the beginning, really theatrical, 3 points, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, holding up fingers.
I think that that is true.
Yeah.
How does that differ from how you perceive what you're doing?
Our choice of story is something we spend a ton of time on. What is it that crystallizes this case? The way we tell that story is very, very deliberate. We spend a ton of time on that first paragraph because we think it's so important to how people see the rest of the trial in terms of choosing the right setting, the right people to be named. What sensory details are focused on? What tense are we using? What's the action? Where do we start that story? Where do we end that story? You get to make so many choices. I talk to my students about thinking of it as you're the director. Where do you point the camera? When do you start rolling? When do you call cut? When do you zoom in? When do you zoom out? It's easy to say, oh, you want to use sensory details, but you can't do that with everything. Mm-hmm. Right? So you want to do it thoughtfully. What is it that you want people to remember or not even realize they're remembering? I think that it's easy to go, we go 1, 2, 3, but we don't just pick 3 facts. Sometimes those facts are things that if you believe them, you go, okay, you've proved your case. Or maybe it's the types of evidence that we want you to remember. We're categorizing it that way. Sometimes it's based on the elements. But those decisions about what the 3 facts are and how we deploy them, we spend a ton of time on because we don't just do it because people like the rule of 3. We think that they're more likely to remember the things that we emphasize here. And so it's sort of like, what are you going to put on your billboard? Right? You only have so much space in people's minds. And the ideas you want to make them remember, you can only advertise so much. And if there's something later in trial that we think might not be clear during the cross or during the direct, then you have to mention an opening so that way it has resonance later on. And so I think of the opening as the roadmap, not just for your theory, but also how you're going to persuade the whole time.
Back to that initial story, what goal do you have specifically with regard to that vignette or that initial story you tell?
I want the jury to know who the bad guy is and the moment when it was bad or the reason that they're bad. Sometimes it's the moment they did the bad thing, or maybe it's the moment they decided to do the bad thing, but you're putting the target in the crosshairs.
Now, direct examination. Let's go through the list here. What do you think is a key thing that UCLA does in the direct examination?
I think that we do a lot of things that everybody else does. I'll name a couple things that I think we do differently. You will rarely hear one of my students say what happened next.
Right.
So that's an example of like conventional wisdom. What happened next? What happened next? I think that question is usually unexciting. I think people sort of tune out a little bit. I want more interesting questions. Why did you do X? Where were you standing? How far were you? How well could you see? I want to be specific. You know, you told us he had the gun in his hand. I don't say what happened next. Where did you see that gun pointed? Right. I want something that tells the jury why the fact that we're asking about is important. I want to not just elicit the information, but want the jury thinking about the information in the way that I want. Right. The studies are really consistent. That saying how far were you versus how close were you? It's the same question, but juries are going to remember the fact differently, literally differently, based on the way you phrase the question. So we spend a lot of time thinking about phrasing that will not just get us the words from the witness, but that will make those words resonate the way we want. I also spend a lot of time with my students thinking about sequencing. There's a tendency, I think, to make all directs chronological. And sometimes that's useful, but often the way you begin and end a direct is what people remember the most. And so if something's really important, I may take it out of chronological order and do it at the end of a direct. maybe gloss over it, make mention it and say, now I want to finish by zeroing in on what you said earlier.
Then in the cross-examination, same question. What is a hallmark of what UCLA does?
I think that's enough suggested plagiarism for today. We still got to go out and compete, Spencer.
You do. That's true. You still got to go out and compete. But folks, I got a lot out of them, didn't I? UCLA is occasionally accused of being dramatic or overly dramatic. First of all, I take it you've heard that yourself, but what's your response?
We are definitely dramatic. I would say that we try not to be overly dramatic, but people want to be entertained. And I think that a lot of the critique comes from, oh, you're more dramatic than some lawyers are in court, to which I'd say, absolutely. It's also true that a lot of lawyers in court ask open-ended questions on cross, don't know hearsay, rely on notes, but they don't need notes, and make tons of mistakes. So I don't know the difference between real life and mock trial necessarily means that what you're doing in mock trial is wrong. I think you've got to earn attention. People want to be engaged. And when we get comments that have gone too far, you know, sometimes that means that we lose some points. But we're not doing it as a gimmick. We're doing it because we think the best way to persuade is to make people listen to you, right? As one of the things I tell my students is, it doesn't matter what you're saying if nobody's listening.
We asked this question of a lot of folks on the show. Now it's your turn. What's your coaching style?
I think it changes based on the student. You try to give each student the support and training that they need. You try to meet them where they are. But what I try to do is make sure that every student knows how much I care about them. I have a good friend. I once asked what the secret to his coaching success was. A guy I coached against in college and a good friend of mine now. And he said, you have to love your students and they have to know that. That crystallized how I felt and how I feel more succinctly than I'd been able to think about it. It's the core of everything we do, right? You want to tell the student to perform differently, to make different decisions, to get better at cross-examination or whatever. But at the core of all that, they have to trust you. And the only way they're going to trust you is if they know you're rooting for them. As much as possible, I want my students to know how much I love them, how much I care for them, whether that's encouraging them, providing positive feedback, not just because you're supposed to give a compliment sandwich, but because you really believe it. When we travel to competitions, we have a tradition that when you get to the airport, we go through security. Everybody gets a handwritten letter that dates back to since I was in college or coaching college mock trial. And, you know, you don't always do it as well as you want. I mean, we're all human, but like everybody listening, I really love my students and I try to make sure they know it.
What coaching achievement are you most proud of and why?
It's the first time I had a student win Top Gun, because that student, Rahul Hari, was on my college team at UC Irvine. And we were always close, but no cigar. Second out of 700, third out of 700. And that whole group of students was in that courtroom. I know it was a one-on-one competition, but they were all there with him. I mean, literally, they were watching on the Zoom, on the live stream, rather. And they were part of an entire text thread, all the alums who'd competed with Rahul, who'd been my students. And it felt like validation of everything we'd worked for 7 years at UCI. And when he won, they all felt like they won the national championship. And what's cool is they put him on the text thread too. He was in the rounds, his phone's off. So as we're driving to the airport afterwards, he's reading it and getting emotional when he sees how much everybody was cheering for him and caring for him. And I've gotten to be part of some really great teams since then. Watching Phil and Jess and Naj win TOC, seeing Phil achieve his dream of winning Top Gun, some of the results you alluded to earlier, getting students, seeing them joyous when they pass the bar or win their first trial or get their first not guilty, like the same stuff everybody experiences. I will tell you though, the one that I can still feel that joy of seeing Rahul win and his whole team celebrate like they'd won too. That was very cool.
Some people have been in various ways over time critical of your approach to coaching or your approach to your program. How has that affected you? And what's been your response?
It's been difficult to give a response because most people who've done that have done it when I'm not there, either on a public forum or by my back, and it gets back to me. And I think my response or my feeling about it is the same as anybody else's. You know, it's not fun to hear critique, especially when you're not there to defend yourself. But I teach my students the best way I know how. And if I hear a critique of the way we're doing things, my first reaction is to evaluate the critique. If I think it's fair, I'm not going to be so annoyed that I'm not going to try to get better. But if I don't think it's fair and I try to be thoughtful about it, then I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because I'm really proud of the successes my students have had in their careers. They're doing really well. I think what we're doing works pretty well.
Let me turn our attention to some folks who are absolutely the opposite of critical of your coaching. Got a few voices I'd like for you to hear.
He's a good dude. He's an excellent coach, excellent educator. Also just a great mentor, just a great friend, great person to know, and someone that I'm very grateful to have met and is a part of my life.
He doesn't lead his teams and his students with fear or a sense of superiority. He leads his students with love and care.
Justin is able to take any student he works with and figure out exactly what that person's voice is and exactly how that person can best tell their story.
Justin is a guy who is frustratingly good at everything, but I think his best skill is the way that he connects with people.
The way he's able to like look into the psychology of a person and befriend them and get to know them and figure out how they can best be heard is truly inspiring and something that I hope I can take away as a coach in this activity as well.
He's taught me so much on not only how to be a great lawyer, but also how to stand up for myself as a young lawyer.
I wouldn't have the success that I had as a law school competitor without Justin. I wouldn't be the trial lawyer that I am without Justin.
Justin is an incredibly special person to me. I've come to rely on him as a friend and a mentor for the last decade and more.
He's someone I'll always look up to. And it's not just because he's a foot and a half taller than me, but because he's a good friend.
Yeah, Justin's touched my life and so many others like me. So thanks, Justin.
How does that make you feel? Listen to those voices, man.
I don't recognize any of those voices. I mean, that's amazing. It's really, really sweet. Thank you.
How many teams have you coached through the years, would you estimate? And how many students would you estimate you've coached through the years? For all comers, all levels.
Ooh. Oh, my God. That's a hard one. I like math and quantifying things, and I don't know the answer to that. It's got to be hundreds of law students, hundreds of college students. At some level or another, more than 1,000 high school students.
Let's get a little bit more mechanical. These are questions I often like to ask. As you know, at UCLA, how many students are on the team?
25 and say 32, 33 at any given point during the year.
How many competitions does UCLA go to?
Go to about 9 in the fall and a little fewer in the spring.
How many coaches do you have per team?
Generally 2. And if it's my team, I might have a co-coach. I might go solo.
Over the years, I'm curious, is there a coaching or strategy decision that you regret or one that sticks in your mind in particular?
Yes.
What is it?
Top Gun 2016. Rahul Uri is the defending Top Gun, trying to become the first person to win twice. And we had as our prosecution theme, he did it before, he did it again, because we were confident that defendant's prior acts, prior similar crime would come in as MO evidence. I was certain of it until round 2 when we were able to exclude it against our opponent. And that night we went back and rewrote our entire prosecution case. As you know, time is really precious at Top Gun, and that really set us back. And he had an amazing opponent in the final that year, and he made the finals. But I'll always wonder if I hadn't made a coaching mistake on Thursday, if we might have had a slightly different result on Sunday.
In terms of teaching, what's your proudest achievement and why?
I'm going to give you 2. It's the career results that my students get when they tell me they got a not guilty in their case, a public defender, when my student like Aiden Welsh wins a big national conviction in a case where somebody did something despicable. That is so exciting. Or to see them getting to do the kind of work they want to do, You just heard Rahul's voice, and he's now winning cases for the United States government. I'm just so proud of them. But also seeing the kind of people they become and seeing like how they feel about themselves. I mean, one of the cool things about teaching trial skills compared to, say, contracts or civil procedure is in those classes, you're affecting the way they think about the law. In trials, you're often affecting how they feel about themselves because it's performance. Mm-hmm. It's connecting. It's emoting. It's opening up. It's being vulnerable. And so we get, as the people who teach these classes, the opportunity to develop not just their legal minds, but their self-confidence and the way they present themselves. That's awesome.
Let's talk about the pod. First, what's gone better than you expected and what has been harder than you expected?
For what's gone better, we're still going. This is episode 89. I didn't think we'd get to episode 8 or 9.
What's been harder than you anticipated?
One thing that's been harder is just making sure we get everybody on. There's still people who are great coaches, great professors, great directors who we've yet to have on. And I know we want to, and I suspect we will. On a personal level, I think the hardest thing is dealing with the UCLA thing. You know, we cover tournament results. My team's done very well. And I'm also the host of the show. And so that can be, I love elephants, but that's a big elephant in the room. And I don't always know how to deal with it.
Talk about the future for a minute. Where do you think you'll be in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Where would you want to be? Where do you think you'll be?
I think I'll be at UCLA. I think that my job may be different, but I think I will be here because I just love it. I get to work with amazing students. I've got great support. I'm very happy here.
You mentioned it may be different. How could that be? How might that be?
Over time, and maybe even relatively soon, I will be coaching less. I think it's important as I build the program to delegate more. I mean, if I had to pick a biggest weakness with me as a director is I don't delegate enough and I don't sort of empower coaches as much as I could. And I'm trying to get better at that. I did that better this year. But I'd like to have more time coaching the coaches and maybe less time coaching directly, even though I love coaching students. I'd like to continue to develop the trial consulting practice I have with trial lawyers. I've now worked, I think, on a dozen of those cases, and I love it. It's a new challenge. I like new challenges.
When we've worked together recently, you use a photo of Heisman to introduce yourself, and you use the present tense when talking about Heisman. How hard has it been to have Heisman not around?
It's been terrible. I miss him a lot. It'll be a year next week. And I thought it would be easier by now.
We started off talking about your childhood. We talked about your education, your work, your teaching. If you had to describe yourself at this point in the life of Justin Bernstein, how would you do it?
I don't think I would. Yeah, I'm not good at that.
What do you think the defining features of you are?
I think I am relentless. I like to constantly be busy. It's very hard for me to like my idea of relaxing is to find another task. I like solving problems, whether they're actual problems or mock problems or math problems. Like I like to be engaged. I don't like being bored.
Where do you think those come from? Do you have any sense of where those traits come from?
I don't know. It's definitely not from my parents because it would annoy them. If we were going on a car trip, if we were driving somewhere, I would say, let's play a game. And they would say, no, we just played a game. I said, when are we going to play the next game? And I'd make them like schedule it. And I do not think I ever said, let's take a break. I mean, I love to play games or to be mentally engaged to the frustration of those around me.
Your dad, he's come up occasionally here in the interview. And I said earlier that he had a difficult relationship with him. But why? What was the deal?
I don't know that it was so much that I had a difficult relationship with him is that he was just a difficult person. I mean, he had bouts in his life where he wasn't talking to almost every important family member at some point. He wasn't a happy guy and he took it out on those around him.
Your mom, Anita, is not only our most dedicated listener, but an endlessly thoughtful, supportive, brilliant, and loving mom. Why didn't you get any of those traits?
I don't know. I'm still looking for them. My mom is awesome. So just as a cheerleader of our team, she will watch as many trials as she can. I'm not exaggerating. When we were on Zoom, she watched more UCLA Zoom trials than I did. Sometimes I'd be coaching another team or I'd need a break or something, but she would watch them constantly. She would tell me her opinions of how things were going. My favorite one ever is when I asked her how the trial was going. She said, "I hate this judge. She seems fair." I'm like, "What do you mean?" She's like, "I like it when they favor us." She sends care packages when we travel. She listens to every episode.
She does, and improves some of them.
She does have opinions about the episodes, yes.
In the family vein here, I also wanted to ask you, there was a time where your mock trial actually brought family closer together for you, sort of inadvertently.
This is a very cool story. So my last year coaching at NYU undergrad, we're at the national championship. After round one, I'm standing outside the tab room. I've been asked to stand guard to make sure people didn't come in. It's what people do when you're 6'5". They're like, "You stand there." A woman came up to the door and I said, "Sorry, the tab room's closed." And she said, "I don't want to go into the tab room. I'm your Aunt Barbara." And because of my dad, I hadn't gotten to know my aunt and uncle and cousins on his side of the family. And the reason that she was in Des Moines, Iowa, for the American Mock Trial Association National Championship is that my cousin Ben was competing for Cornell, also an All-American. Congrats, Ben. And my cousin Meredith had competed from Cornell before him. And so it turns out that even though our families had been separated, they were a mock trial family. So maybe this was in my blood a little bit, but that spurred us to have a great relationship. And I just, my Uncle Jonathan, my Aunt Babs, and my cousins Ben and Meredith and, you know, their families, I'm really lucky that we were able to reconnect through mock trial.
Okay, let's finish up with some, I would say quick hits, but I think they're more quick-ish hits. Okay, so.
Okay, I'm ready.
It's a rapid fire section for the interview. You got to be ready for questions coming from lots of different people and different angles. Okay.
I'm stretching. I'm ready. Okay.
Okay. First, another guest.
Hey, Justin, what came first, your impression of a horse or your impression of an elephant?
Fair question.
So that's Chris DeBarinis-Arobe, my co-counsel from college at Berkeley. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
He was on the team the year after me because he's a year younger. And they were 8-0 at Nationals, but didn't get to advance the playoffs because of the perverse scoring system. And, you know, that's affected his life since then. As I can imagine, you know, that's why he comes on to ask me questions about animal noises. So we can forgive Chris. So yes, which one came first? Oh, the elephant noises came first because I've loved elephants since I was little, but my horse impression is much better.
You got an easy one here for you. What's your deepest, darkest secret?
Pass.
Okay, this is kind of a predictable, but I think challenging question coming from yet another listener. This is my last exhibit for you here.
Your research is unbelievable. Why are you not this prepared when we are working together?
Quiet. Listen to the next question.
Hey, Justin. I want you to imagine you've got a March Madness-like bracket with the regions being the places you've lived and the teams being the best meals you've ever had there. Take us through the tournament and who makes it out of the regions and into the semis and wins, and why.
Is that Judge Yaroslavsky?
It sure is.
Hey, Dave. It's kind of fun when you have a friend who becomes a judge because you get to keep calling them by their first name. In New York, my favorite place, Peter Luger's, not for the steak, for the burgers, which they only serve at lunch. Best burger I've ever had. San Diego, La Posta Mexican food. It's a 24-hour hole-in-the-wall place. I mean, it's not even hole-in-the-wall. It's just the hole. There's no wall. you do not want to go there by yourself. Their burritos are unreal. Orange County, I'm going to go with Javier's because the margaritas and the view are unbelievable. Look at that. I'm even counting ambiance like you would.
I love it.
Berkeley, I'm going to go with Zachary's Pizza. The best deep dish pizza. It's not in Chicago. It's in Berkeley. And in Los Angeles, I'm still trying to figure it out.
You don't know the answer.
I don't know that I have a one.
Do we have a national champion? You like rankings. You know what? You're known to force people to rank their favorite dishes at dinner and really all meals. I think you may have to rank these.
So I don't like having to rank this because I love so many places to eat. But I thought about if I could have one restaurant across the street from wherever I'm living at any one time, it would be La Posta.
What's your favorite legal movie?
My Cousin Vinny.
Why?
Because I'm an adult
Like, just hear the Phil vitriol there.
So my cousin Vinny is probably the answer. I also love A Few Good Men. I would say that among the lesser mentioned legal movies on our show, Legally Blonde is very good. And for TV show.
Go ahead. You can make it a TV show too. That's fine. Go.
Thank you.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I figure since you're hosting, there are no rules anymore. Better Call Saul, I think, has some of the more realistic legal scenes. And actually, despite his corruption, he is otherwise a very effective advocate.
What's the best spreadsheet you've ever made?
The next one. Is that a good philosophical answer?
No.
Okay.
Justin, let's finish this thing up strong. A question you might have been able to predict. What is your favorite thing you're good at and your favorite thing that you're not so good at?
What a thoughtful, insightful question to end an interview. Where did you come up with that?
Yeah, well, I got my places. Quit stalling.
All right. So favorite thing I'm good at, you're not going to accept mock trial. Although that really is the answer. I love it too much.
You're right, though. I won't accept
it. So the other two things that I absolutely love and that I'm good at are eating and watching TV. I am very good at watching TV.
Yes, yikes. And the other half of the coin?
So my answer forever has been skiing. I love to ski. I'm just really bad at it. Sadly, I think that basketball has joined that list. I once was slow and uncoordinated. Now I'm slower and less coordinated. But I do love to play.
Justin, thanks for joining us on the pod.
Thanks for having me on. I love what you guys are doing.
Well, that was fun. Oh, Justin's not here to agree with me. It was a fun interview. Special thing to get to interview your friend. And I wasn't kidding about the preparation for it. I was quite nervous, honestly, about trying to do my best to get it right. So I hope that I did, folks. And if I didn't, well, it's Justin's fault. And that's our show. On the next episode of Unscripted Direct, to welcome Justin back to the show, we introduce our newest co-host, Bob Loblaw, who unveils the new name of the show, Bob Loblaw's Law Pod with J-Bomb and Common Spence. We also announce the newest competition on the circuit, the Banana Stand Challenge, and its whopping $250,000 grand prize. It's going to be on fire. Please don't sue us, Netflix and or other very large corporations who own the rights to Arrested Development. We're just kidding. Having a good time. And now it's time for some credits. And these are going to be some fun credits because to make this episode possible, it took a lot of help from a lot of people. So I want to thank them all right here and right now. I'm going to start off with the one and only Anita Charney. Not only is she our most dedicated listener, she unsurprisingly proved to be an incredible and invaluable co-conspirator for this episode. Thank you so much, Anita. Next on my list, Justin's amazing brother, Ari Bernstein. Ari, while Justin only had the decency to promise to pay for a third date with Shima, I look forward to buying you a drink in New York the first time I see you there. And I say that despite the fact that you were holding out on me by not sharing that other basketball nickname. Now, of course, I take that as a sign of you're just being a great brother. Sal Baxamusa, thank you for letting me barge into your friend group for a few minutes. I wish you good luck with nuclear fusion. Valerie also misses you and says hello, and I'm glad you got out of that baggage carousel. Judge David Yaroslavsky, I didn't know you before you were a judge, so it'll always be judge to me. Thank you for letting me pester you on the weekend, repeatedly. Chris DeBoreno Sarobe, I still owe you an elephant impersonation from Justin. I'll get it, I promise. Next up on my list of thank yous, Enrico Trevisani, Rahul Hari, Deeksha Kohli, Kyle DeCamp, and of course, Phil Pasquarello and the amazing Jess Pasquarello. Thank you each for giving us such an eloquent window into what Justin has meant to each of you. Justin's taught you well. Next, the many folks in the circuit who gave me questions to ask Justin, you know who you are, and thank you. Now, I should say, you may not have heard your question in the final edit. If so, in keeping with the words of a great character in a mock trial fact pattern, this episode includes all evidence I found that incriminates Justin. So don't even try to hit me with what the FBI calls a Lone Star Cross. You didn't do this, you didn't do that. Believe me, I did. And of course, the Sam Chase who edits the pod and is our chief lyricist. In Sam's words, so I'll live it while I've got it. And what I've got, I'm living fine. But when you tell your kids your stories, you know they'd all rather hear mine. And last but absolutely not least, Justin, thank you. Your generosity, wit, and yes, absolutely wisdom. They all brighten the days of those you encounter, and especially the day of your erstwhile co-host. Thank you for saying yes to this silly project. See you next week, Ian. Yeah.